This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we are talking with Jeffrey Tulis about his book, The Rhetorical Presidency. Jeffrey Tulis is associate professor in the Department of Government at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of a number of books. His most recent book, just out, published with co-author Nicole Mello, is The Legacies of Losing in American Politics. Other books, The Constitutional Presidency in 2009 and The Limits of Constitutional Democracy in 2010. I think it's safe to say he's one of our best scholars of American presidential rhetoric and the uses of executive power within our constitutional system. Jeffrey Tulis, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
So the book, The Rhetorical Presidency, is described by many scholars as a masterwork in understanding presidential rhetoric and the ways in which presidents pursue their power and policies. This is the 31st year. Last year was the 30th anniversary of the book. Princeton Classics is out with a new edition with a great foreword by Russell Muirhead. And I wanted to just read for our listeners the second paragraph in his foreword, just to maybe set the stage here. He says, quote, "No book offers a more profound diagnosis of the American presidency today than Jeffrey Tulis's The Rhetorical Presidency. Indeed, since the book situates the presidency in relation to the larger constitutional order, it offers a way of understanding the regime itself." Jeffrey, it seems here at the beginning, though, you're obviously a noted scholar of the American presidency. Your state of the your assessment of the presidential rhetoric of Donald Trump as he completes his first year in office.
Yeah, I talk about that in the new afterword for this new edition. And Trump, one of the misunderstandings of the rhetorical presidency has been that somehow presidents in the 19th century, where they spoke very different, were not rhetorical. And presidents since Woodrow Wilson, who used rhetoric regularly to go to the people through speeches over the media, TV, radio, and so forth, that those are the rhetorical presidencies. And if you look in encyclopedias that have now picked up the rhetorical presidency, some of them define it as this sort of modern period when I had picked the book to capture the whole thing. So rhetorical presidency has changed, but there's a certain sense in which it's always been in some way rhetorical. But what's interesting is that this common view of the book, again, a slight misreading, suggests that somehow the older way was good and the new way, since Woodrow Wilson, in which presidents regularly give speeches, was bad. And again, it's more complicated than that. And this is all a big preface to your question, because In Donald Trump, we have all the fears of the rhetorical presidency that I think may be overstated with respect to previous modern presidents come true in Donald Trump. He is, in fact, every worst attribute of the modern rhetorical presidency with none of the good attributes.
Now that's a very interesting observation, a loaded observation. Could I ask you, what do you mean? In what ways is he the fulfillment of that? Because I see it, and I think you argue this in your afterword. Ronald Reagan was a master communicator. That's widely known and very proficient at using the arts of, say, television to go beyond, say, what many regard as a rather hostile media. Donald Trump, though, uses social media, and in particular Twitter, to go beyond his critics in the media. Is that not rather a continuation of the rhetorical presidency, what makes Trump so bad?
Yeah, it's a continuation, but such an intensification as to be, an unmitigated problem. So to take your example of Ronald Reagan, Reagan really did, in many ways, as you suggest, push the boundaries of modern practices some, and he was, as you suggest, actually very good at communicating to the extent that he was persuasive. But Ronald Reagan, like all modern presidents, actually toggled between a more traditional conception of the office, one that actually pays heed to the architecture and norms and ligaments of the office in which the president, that the office that the president inhabits. He paid homage to that at the same time that he would, as it were, step out of it or push its boundaries with respect to the rhetorical appeals. So all modern presidents, including Ronald Reagan, you could say toggled between the modern rhetorical effort to get beyond, say, over the heads of Congress, or in the case of Trump, even over the heads of the media itself, toggled between that and using, in fact, the resources of the office to enhance their persuasiveness. So Reagan had an understanding of the office. Trump really does not see the office as anything other than a set of personal resources, and his use of rhetoric is not only connected to his own personal ambitions and personal desires, but it's taken on a kind of exaggerated perversity that we've never seen. Well, I shouldn't say we've never seen. The closest that we've seen anything like Trump is actually in the 19th century, in the presidency of Andrew Johnson. Andrew Johnson was the only president, the only sitting president, about whom it could be said he was a thoroughgoing demagogue. He wasn't, however, elected, and he left office in disgrace, impeached, and escaped conviction by one vote. Every one of his proposals was defeated in Congress. Congress's competing proposals were passed over his vetoes, including amendments to the Constitution. And so there was incredible institutional pushback and constraint on Andrew Johnson.
Yeah.
But he was a demagogue, and in fact, one of the articles of impeachment for Johnson, which was actually not voted on in the Senate but was voted on in the House, was for his bad rhetoric, for his demagogic rhetoric.
Now, that sort of harkens back, I mean, I think here in this discussion of Donald Trump and now Andrew Johnson, though, to your first chapter in the book, which is, you know, aptly called The Old Way. And
Right. You
address what the founders were concerned about when it came to political power generally, but executive power more particularly. And demagoguery was one of those concerns. And that sort of sets the stage for what you call the common law, quote, that regulated how presidents were expected to make appeals for their power in office.
Right. So in the Andrew Johnson case, the fact that the polity and the other institutions reacted the way they did is evidence of that common law. In other words, it was simply thought unacceptable to be the way he was. Now, that's a long windup to say that the problem that we face today is that there is not as clear an institutional and cultural pushback to the unacceptability, which in some ways is as outrageous or more outrageous than Johnson, in the rhetoric of Donald Trump.
Why do you think that is?
There isn't pushback, or that his rhetoric is so bad?
Well, take your pick. I think that there isn't pushback as you see it. How do you account for that?
Well, part of it is the change that this book is describing over these more than two centuries, such that those 19th century norms don't have the same power and resonance that they had in the 19th century. So while they had some before Trump, they were eroded. There was this sense that there was this growing sense that the very core of the presidency was popular leadership, not an adjunct to or an assistance to the presidency, but the core of it. So that sort of set the table for a new kind of demagogue before one, in fact, emerged. The second aspect of it is Trump's, demagogic skills, you might say. He really is, and this is really unlike Andrew Johnson, he's really the first sort of Orwellian demagogue. I mean, I talk about this some in the afterword. What is puzzling, should be puzzling to most people, is Given that I've just said that there's some norm erosion already before Trump, how is it possible then, as I think most people would agree, that any candidate, or for that matter, any president previous to Trump in the modern era, who had said any one of the hundreds of outrageous things that he said, would have suffered really grievous political harm for that, either not been a viable candidate, because we can think of, or not a successful, or hounded out of office or something. We can think of all sorts of examples of presidential candidates who did things that were gaffes, that were nowhere near as outrageous as what Trump has done, but that cost them office. Howard Dean sort of, it's Roar. I don't know if you mean, remember Howard Dean?
Well, I remember that very well. I was watching it,
right.
Yes.
And he was over after that. Ed Muskie's appearing to possibly cry in defending his wife. And we can just go on and on of episodes,
yeah.
and particularly utterances that were considered gaffes or that were just devastating. And one would have, in fact, the original primary opponents to Trump assumed that that was going to happen to him, and it didn't. And the question then becomes why. And the answer is actually connected to an odd insight that he had, which is that if he intensified or double, tripled, or quadrupled down on the gaffes, they actually became successful instruments for him rather than disabling factors. So in the afterword, I describe this as a three sort of step process. He has a profusion of such utterances, so there are many of them. So they sort of get not exactly canceled out, but diluted by virtue of the profusion of them. He repeats them over and over again. That's a very Orwellian thing. That's how the big lie is affected in Orwell's 1984, through a process of a leader's repetition. And then finally, he projects them. So he anticipates his own vices, say corruption or whatever it is, and then projects it on his opponent. So instead of him being corrupt, Hillary's corrupt. Instead of him being a liar,
yeah.
she's a liar, and so forth. Or other enemies, whether they be his primary opponents or his opponents in the Senate or the special prosecutor or his own attorney general or whoever.
Yeah, yeah, so no. I think, too, yeah. You know, it's interesting, and I don't disagree with anything that you're necessarily saying. The journalist Selena Zito coined a phrase that a lot of people have repeated, which is
yeah.
one learns to take Trump seriously, but not literally. And I've always thought that had resonance because there's also, and I don't want to take this too far afield. It seems to me there is a background of, you know, his rhetoric launching him forward in part because the current ruling class bipartisan seems to have failed on some crucial things, and the American people sensing this, and enough of them sensing that Trump, all of these flaws might be their guy, and in a way they sort of like his bruiser tactics.
Well, the question is, who's the they? You know, I mean, who's the they?
Well, those who voted for him, I would think primarily.
Yeah, but I mean, it was much closer election than he gives you to believe.
Well, it was an election. I don't think anyone, including Donald Trump and his advisors, thought he would win, which is interesting in itself.
Win, right.
Yeah, yeah. So, by the way, I want to go back and just a history lesson here because I think it's and I really enjoy.
Can we pause on this seriously, literally point for a
sure,
second?
Sure, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. Because I think that that's actually part of the problem. He has succeeded by persuading people to take him seriously. Another way to read that is to say, literally, the stuff may be refutable or wrong or a lie, but behind it is a message that is worth attending to. And if that's what you mean, one emboldens this. And so there's a sense in which he needs to be taken more literally and less seriously. So now, if you mean only by seriously that one has to worry or be wary of or be on one's guard or resist or something like that, well, seriously certainly is the appropriate word there. But if seriously means that there is something that should be genuinely respected beneath the rhetoric that on its surface seems so ridiculous, That seems to me to have actually exacerbated the problem rather than contended with it. It needs to be taken more literally and less seriously.
Well, I don't know. I don't want to put words in. I think Selena Zito coined the phrase because people understood that there are these excesses of Donald Trump, but yet there are policies underneath that he represents that they favor, and they can't get either the leadership in the Republican Party to support them vigorously enough or to acknowledge it, or, of course, the Democrats being something altogether different, and that somehow they saw Donald Trump seriously in their corner and would look past all of the other things that I think you're correctly diagnosing
right
here. Yeah. So thinking about the old way, because I thought that was this older understanding and the things that the founders, that generation, were trying to protect against with regard to executive power. Maybe talk about that and how, and I loved your study of George Washington in this regard also.
Yeah, so I'm not sure I understand the question, so.
Oh, no, you talk about in the opening chapter the old way of understanding American
right
rhetoric, which gets transformed, you know, as you argue, by Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. I mean, maybe just talk about that, because I think enough.
You want me to just describe the old way a
little
bit?
Yeah, describe the old way and what it was designed to do. Yeah.
Okay. So the difference between the old way and the new way, the old way is, first of all, presidents use rhetoric all the time, but they could be used, the old way is a different set of understandings of what it means to use it properly. And basically, in the old way, a president would direct their policy rhetoric primarily to Congress, and that most of that rhetoric directed to Congress, but not necessarily all, but most of it would also be written. So policy rhetoric would be written and directed to Congress. Now, that didn't mean that it was secret. It was public, so it could be read by anybody. But it was understood that the principal audience was the Congress, so it was written for that audience, though maybe visible to all. Whereas popular rhetoric, that is rhetoric that was actually designed with the populace in mind, had a different character than it does today. It was about constitutional issues or constitutional principles. It was sometimes about the broad direction of the administration's policies without the specific policy proposals. And it was about the case for and the need to prepare the citizenry or sustain the citizenry through war. So war rhetoric, constitutional rhetoric, and broad rhetoric that connects the direction of the administration to the understanding of the Constitution that president had. That was thought to be the old way, where the president, what most of what we think of as presidential rhetoric today, which are arguments for specific policy initiatives, that those would not be principally designed to appeal to popular passions, and they wouldn't be the subject of ongoing political campaigns, because, of course, early in the 19th century, presidents didn't even do political campaigns on their own behalf. Others did.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Think about and also the old way being about formality. And, you know,
right,
Russell Muirhead has a wonderful discussion of this,
right,
I thought, in the foreword, and you link it to Tocqueville and
right
how, you know, democracies need formality, and yet they are not aware of how much they need it. And what
right
it and what it protects, and this is the old way. These forms, which are you know, they are what they are. They're difficult to endure, but they seem to bring out the best of those in the office. And that seems to me, if we think about this transition, something that's just inescapably lost. I mean, that's just a cost that has to be paid. Is the loss of those forms.
Right. And one interesting evidence of the power of those forms comes up in one of the persistent criticisms I've gotten of the book. In the 19th century, it turns out that presidents did try to mobilize the people in the way the 20th century presidents do through anonymous newspaper op-eds, editorials, that sort of thing, sometimes written by their close friends and sometimes written literally by themselves. Some critics of the book have said, see, they were popular leaders back in the 19th century, too. And what that misses is the importance of form. In other words, why did the president feel they had to be anonymous, had to do it in this indirect way? Why couldn't they just, standing in front of the crowd, why couldn't they just say what they wanted? And the answer is because they were attending to form.
Yeah, it's interesting in this regard, just thinking about Abraham Lincoln's presidency at the beginning of the Civil War. And I mean, he would obviously have had the need, a great need, to appeal to the people directly. And you argue that he doesn't
mobilizing
the country for war. Yeah.
In fact, I describe him on his way to the White House when these crowds, he greets the crowds off the train as they're going from Illinois to Washington, and they keep asking him to, they're really hungry for what he wants to say, and they shout questions and stuff, and he very patiently says he explains to them why he can't talk, and I talk about that a little bit. One of the good things about these 19th century transcribers, newspaper reporters, is that they not only transcribed the things that presidents said, but they transcribed in brackets the crowd interjections and reactions. So you can see in these transcripts his resistance to these popular demands that he say more. And in fact, he develops a kind of speech about not making speeches on that trip. So even though it's about the Civil War, and it would be perfectly, in a way, legitimate even under the old way to make a kind of exception in that circumstance, which he eventually does through things like the Gettysburg Address and so forth. But
Well, now we've talked some about Donald Trump and Andrew Johnson. Another name is lurking, though, in this connection, at least in the popular mind, and that's the presidency of Andrew Jackson. How does he fit into this old way analysis?
Yeah, I think that there's some that the historians have created, well, not exactly a myth, because he did have a democratic and populist agenda, and he did move the country in ways that, for example, Steve Bannon found attractive to model for Trump, and they put his portrait up in the his portrait's in the Oval Office, though I'm quite confident that Trump knows very little about Andrew Jackson. But Bannon thought he did. Now, what's interesting is that Andrew Jackson, while he had policies that pushed in a more democratizing direction, although he also had policies, by the way, very similar to some modern conservatives that want to sort of cut back on government, his reputation as a demagogue, as really by some historians, is really not accurate. And so, what's striking to me is that he's a guy whose temperament seemed to be demagogic, but when you actually look at him in his office, he does not behave that way. His most important speeches are written ones to the Congress protesting a censor of him and things like that, and on the bank. And he does not go around the country campaigning for his policy initiatives. In the afterward, I contrast his inaugural address with Trump's, because you wouldn't, from Bannon's description, you would have thought they would have been similar, but in fact, Jackson's inaugural address is a very elegantly crafted address of relatively few paragraphs gives the listener some sense of how he interprets the oath of office he's been taking. Trump's address says nothing about the Constitution, nothing about the oath of office, pledges his fidelity to the people understood as his supporters, and is, you know, something like 70 paragraphs rather than 14, because they're written in a kind of tweet-like form. The inaugural address takes the form of a series of tweets. So Andrew Jackson actually turns out to be a really good exemplar of the old way, in that he was a man whose temperament, maybe a person like Bannon was right to say, is similar to Trump, but whose temperament was very much cabined, you might say, and schooled by the forms and formalities of the time.
Interesting. You have a discussion of the Federalist Papers throughout the book, And you got one understanding of executive power in the Federalist Papers, apart from the numbers of the series in the Federalist Papers devoted to executive powers, the idea of auxiliary precaution, and that you have one branch closest to the people at times overheating, and at that time it's the job of the president to temper that with a veto maybe or in other ways, and that is to actually stand guard.
Right.
Over the Constitution. And as I read your book, that stuck out in my mind as the thing that just sort of gets lost as we move into this new realm of presidential rhetoric, that the president now understands himself very democratically to be a part of the people, to be a part of this process in an aggressive way, and constitutional forms and procedures and norms that they are there to protect seems to fall by the wayside, or am I overly gloomy in that regard? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. That not only, I think the point you're making is not only were they at one time constrained by these constitutional practices, norms, customs, and so forth, but they saw themselves as the custodian of them for the country more. And so that they had to have a much more active role. That was part of what it meant to be president. And that is certainly. That withered some in the 20th century, but it's really dead in the current administration. I mean, that's the really sad thing. There's absolutely no sense of that piece of it.
Well, I think about Barack Obama, the pen and the phone, as a way in which of making law, making rules apart from any sense of a need to work or compromise with Congress. I mean, it seems to me in a lot of ways, too, it's hard to understand Trump. Or one can understand Trump when one thinks about the use of executive power, both under Obama and under George W. Bush.
I think Obama is quite distinct from Trump because in Obama's case, you might remember he started to try and be what he called a postpartisan president, which he didn't put it this way, but could be one that's modeled in some sense on George Washington. He tried that at the beginning. He was, as you know, Mitch McConnell and others announced before he had proposed anything that they would oppose whatever it was just because it was his and not because they necessarily disagreed with it. And Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein have written a book. It's even worse than, do you know the book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks? In which they develop a notion of hyperpartisanship. A lot of people focus on polarization, but what's interesting about hyperpartisanship is it's a kind of partisan who is so focused on only defeating the opposition and achieving office that one is willing to sacrifice one's own policy goals. So they describe a whole series of largely unprecedented changes during the Obama administration in which the polarized and hyperpartisan Republican Party opposed policies that they themselves had previously advanced when Obama himself said he would advance them on their behalf. And so they have a couple famous examples from McCain, who he had run it against. Obama put in the hopper, a piece of legislation McCain had previously introduced, and even McCain opposed his own previous initiative.
It's interesting.
Are you there?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Just thinking in that regard, though, the ways in which Obama understood the use of executive power, particularly in his second term, seemed to me acknowledging.
Right. In his second term, he became very partisan, and his justification for that was what I've just been describing.
So he actually
had a kind of constitutional defense of what appears to be an extra constitutional move.
That is,
he's repairing a defect. I've written about that. There's a guy at Regent University.
What would be the defect? I mean, is there some sort of constitutional requirement that Congress is supposed to work with the president?
The defect is in the sense that the defect in Congress is that Congress is not supposed to be a simply partisan body. For example, the Speaker of the House, which now is the head of the majority party, can be elected not even from a congressperson. You could have somebody from outside of Congress. And yet the Speaker of the House wedded to the majority party. Now they've developed such rules, again, only the Republicans in this instance, the Hastert rule, which says we won't even bring a bill up that could secure a majority support in the Congress as a whole if it doesn't have a majority support in the governing caucus. Well, that is a problem. That is a constitutional problem for separation of powers.
I would acknowledge that. Thinking about the old way, how did it lose out? Why did it lose out? In what ways?
Well, it didn't entirely lose out, is what I want to suggest. So okay. One of the arguments of the book is, if you mean by lose out, it recedes in public and civic consciousness. That's true. And the reason for that is the success of Woodrow Wilson's critique of the constitutional order and his advancing of a new notion of presidential leadership that took hold and forms the backdrop for most citizen and politician understandings of what it means to be a good president. So the book basically says you've got two things going on simultaneously. You've got the people's consciousness of what the presidency is and what it's supposed to be like. But the Constitution is the same Constitution as it was initially, because the amendments that we have haven't really altered anything relating to the old way. So the Constitution continues to operate under the theory that animates it, which was the old one. So one of the central theses of the book is that the modern presidency is, as it were, caught between the layers of the old and new presidency, because they both operate. And that's why presidents are toggling between them. And so that's what we began our conversation by saying. What's so unusual about Trump is there is no toggling, and he acts as if in a way that actually ignores and overrides any continuing effect of the Constitution.
Theodore,
he acts as if it's not there. Yeah.
So you in particular note Theodore Roosevelt and his campaign for the Hepburn Act, which is the need to regulate railroads and to delegate power to the Interstate Commerce Commission. And you note he has this understanding of himself. He is now going to exceed the common law of the regulation of how presidents appeal for their policies. But he argues he is doing this in the name of protecting the Constitution. Talk
right
about that. That's interesting.
So as many of your listeners may know, that at the time that Teddy Roosevelt came to the office, around the turn of the century, was a time of great economic transition worldwide. So that's the beginning of the Bolshevik Revolution and other such real serious critiques and attacks on capitalism. And the United States was not immune to that, because some of the pathologies of capitalism, some of which we're experiencing today, gross inequality possibly, if it's not managed, were palpable, trusts and things like that. Teddy Roosevelt comes to office as somebody who still thinks that properly managed capitalism is a vital attribute of the American constitutional order, but left unattended to is a problem. And if others attempt to solve that problem, it could bring the whole polity down. That's his. So this is for him a major, major point of inflection for American political development. And so he thinks that the potential crisis is so grave that it merits unusual acts of presidential leadership to rectify it, and that includes breaking the norms of leadership in order to advance these policies that were our original sort of regulatory state policies, trust busting, railroad rate regulation is the one that I discuss in detail in the book, in which he gives an actual campaign tour around the country to build up support for this piece of legislation in the Congress to regulate the railroads, which is something that presidents hadn't done before.
Do you think his assessment of a crisis is accurate? Or is it the case that, you know, one throws out a crisis in order to justify breaking of, you know, these norms that protected constitutional liberty?
Right. It's certainly the case that I say in the book that presidents since Teddy Roosevelt do exactly what you say. They understand the rhetorical power of crisis, and therefore they either, if they don't engineer crises, they rhetorically describe things as crises that maybe are not. And that has obviously a big problem, because we lose over time the ability to distinguish between genuine and spurious, or we are skeptical about the genuine because we think they're all spurious. So that's a big problem. And just the way you say. Now, whether that was true of Teddy Roosevelt is a more debatable point. I think my view is that he did diagnose a genuine crisis.
So talk about, I mean, this is interesting, I thought, the Theodore Roosevelt and the Woodrow Wilson, maybe in my mind, another example related. This idea that, I mean, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, a different episode, the speech he gives in Kansas, the well-known speech, I'm blanking on the name of the town, starts with a P. Is this something to the effect of the Constitution cannot stand in the way of, I don't think he says human rights, but something like that, rights of the worker, labor rights, et cetera. I mean, I guess that's sort of the thing I'm thinking about when I think of Theodore Roosevelt and the abuse of rhetoric.
That was a speech after he was president, right? After he was out of office.
Yeah.
So there are really two Teddy Roosevelts. There's the Teddy Roosevelt through the term he actually served, and then there's the later Bull Moose Teddy Roosevelt. And so Gene Yarborough has written a book very critical of Teddy Roosevelt from a kind of libertarian perspective. But my only dispute with it is that the best parts of the argument against Teddy Roosevelt from that perspective are what he has said after he was actually president.
I've always understood the two Teddy Roosevelts, but I've also understood the second one to be really building on principles in the first, just extending them out.
I think in the first case, he did what I suggested, which is, for example, he argued that this was a kind of temporary emergency move rhetorically and politically to solve a particular crisis, not the beginning of a new, practice for the presidency. Secondly, I think that his argument about what might be called managed capitalism really just was that. It was a very more moderate argument than the kind of progressive arguments that he makes afterwards.
Okay.
I mean, that's an interpretive debate one could have, but that's my view. Yeah.
So moving forward, I mean, in thinking about your arguments, Theodore Roosevelt, and we have Woodrow Wilson, who makes any number, take your pick, criticisms of the founders' Constitution and of their political science, FDR, JFK, LBJ, this really is sort of a transformation of executive power in the 20th century that begins with Teddy Roosevelt, and we now have the new way of thinking about this. And so what do you think we have gained positively from this change?
Well, I think it turned out that the general principles of the old way included creating an office that provided the possibility of energy in the political order. So the Federalists go on and on about providing an energetic executive and providing energy to the constitutional order as a whole, and also leadership in the sense of the ability to coordinate and lead an increasingly complex commercial republic. And so one of the arguments that is reasonable is that the original Constitution did not actually provide as much energy as was required, as the system that it generated required, and that that becomes more clearer in the 20th century as our engagement in the world and the complexity of our own domestic arrangements becomes more palpable. So the many attributes of the presidency that are new in practice and new, as it were, on the ground could arguably be, you know, thought to be extensions of the deeper principles of a commitment to energy and coordination and so forth, and unity in the executive and all that sort of stuff. All the arguments that justified that support many of the practical innovations of the presidency in the 20th century.
Are we in though a crisis now? Is this new way of executive power beginning with Roosevelt, as you note, has it reached a point where new thinking needs to happen? Maybe we need to go back to these older sources and find creative ways to reincorporate them into our practice.
Yes, but not quite the way you think. And so I am, a book that I haven't published yet, but I am writing now on democratic decay and the politics of deference, basically addresses the question you've just asked. And the answer you're getting from a lot of people now, which is the one that I'm going to push back on, is that basically the problem is an imperial presidency, and that worry is certainly intensified and given some plausibility by the Trump presidency. But people think of it, as you suggested, by virtue of the Obama presidency and things that some earlier presidents have done as well. My view is that what looks like a kind of new imperial presidency is actually a pathology of the legislature. What we're really seeing in the 20th century is a profound abdication of power on the part of the legislative branch.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, that would actually be a part of my answer as I think about this. It's a loss of, but I think the legislature can, you can't decouple that though from this tremendous growth in executive power. I mean, the legislature is perfectly willing to sit back and let these things happen because it takes them off the hook. And also they see themselves as, they are managing this administrative state, which, as you note, starts with the Hepburn Act that Theodore Roosevelt, the modern administrative state.
They're not managing it.
But that's how they see their power. Rather than being a deliberative Republican body, they sit back and see themselves, I think, as connecting their clients up with various parts of the federal government.
I agree with all of that, and that's to me the deepest problem. And so, because the normal picture of the president as imperial is one that is sort of an imperial president grabs power that he isn't authorized to have, kind of thing, right? And the problem is that Congress, as you've just outlined, is authorizing all over the place when it's not attending to things. So, and there are lots of interesting examples about it. And one of the things that happens is that because the Congress has a kind of institutional amnesia about what it would mean to be an aggressively active Republican, small R Republican legislature, as you described, is that it means when it does wake up, as it periodically does, and tries to attend to business, it does it in an overly partisan way than it would have done if it retained some of the vitality that it once had in the 19th century. And so you, just to give you one example, now when presidents are asked for information and so forth, and they decline to give it for, say, executive privilege, two things happen. One, legislatures often defer to some legal determination of whether that is true or not. And then two, if they do decide to push back and say, well, the claim of executive privilege is not as important as our need to know, they attempt to prosecute any contempt citation that they may issue through the Justice Department that probably advised the executive official to declare executive privilege in the first place.
Rather than use their constitutional weapons, of which they have many, to attack the executive agency.
Exactly.
Department.
And yeah, among exactly. those yeah. among those weapons that they don't use anymore, and Josh Chafin talked
yeah.
about this in a new book, is their own power of out-of-court contempt, where
yeah.
you do the trial yourself in Congress, and you put the person in the cell that it still exists in the Congress until they're willing to talk. So in other words, the judiciary has nothing to do with it. And that's gone by the wayside, but it's symbolic of an older understanding of an institution that really stood up for itself.
Yes, yes, oh, I agree completely. So, Jeffrey, thank you for your time. And,
we've done already, man.
And
went fast.
And, well, hey, that means you were having a good time.
I did.
And thank you for discussing your book. We've been talking with Jeffrey Tulis, the author of The Rhetorical Presidency. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.